Chapter 6. The Surprise lay moored, head and stern in 40-fathom water, on the north side of the island in Cumberland Bay, the only sheltered road. And Jack Aubrey sat on his quarterdeck in an elbow chair with an awning over his head to keep off the sun, digesting his dinner. Lobster soup, three kinds of fish, a roast shoulder of kid, sea elephant steak grilled to a turn, and contemplating the now familiar shore of Juan Fernandez. No more than 2 cables' lengths away began the noble sward, a sweet, smooth green with 2 brooks running through it upon which his tent had been pitched until that morning, a green theatre rimmed by green forest, and beyond the forest wild, rocky hills rising in abrupt, fantastic shapes, black crags in general, but clothed with green wherever greenery could take hold, and not the rank, lush, excessive exuberance of the tropics either, but the elegant green of the County Clare. On one of the nearer precipices he could see Stephen and Martin creeping up a goat path, anxiously shepherded by Padine, Stephen's servant and an intrepid cragsman, whose enormous frame had been founded on seabirds' eggs throughout his childhood, by Bondon, with a coil of 1-inch line over his shoulder, and by Calamy, who was obviously giving advice, begging them to take care, to watch where he was putting his feet, and not to look down. They'd heard of a hummingbird peculiar to the island, the cock being bright pink and the hen bright green. And since the recovery of the invalids, they'd spent what waking hours they could spare from the Juan Fernandez ferns and epiphytes to combing the countryside in search of a nest. From a ravine over towards East Bay came the crackle of gunfire. That was Howard of the Marines, the American officers, and a party of liberty men who were roaming the island with fowling pieces, shooting anything that moved. Only a small party, and one made up of those particularly skilled men who until now had scarcely had a free hour from the urgent task of refitting the ship. A small party because for most of the frigate's people liberty had come to an end with yesterday's evening gun, and they'd spent this forenoon striking camp. The hospital tent had been an imposing affair, with ample room for all the severe cases of scurvy and the other invalids, and carrying water, wood, dried fish, and other stores aboard. There might still be a score of people on the island, apart from the lookout men he'd established on the Sugarloaf, which commanded a fine view of the Pacific, but they had only a short time left. They had to be back before the end of the afternoon watch, when he intended to weigh, run out to the sheltered anchorage on what little tide there was, for the wind was steady in the south-southeast, and steer as straight and fast as ever he could for the Galapagos Islands. They hadn't found the Norfolk at Juan Fernandez, which was perhaps just as well, with so many surprises unfit for action. Nor had they found any trace of her having been there, but that didn't signify a great deal, since she might perfectly well have watered at Masafuera, 100 miles to the west, or have put into Valparaiso, where she meant to refit. They hadn't found the Norfolk. He'd made a very slow passage, and he'd been obliged to spend a long while on the island to recover his invalids and patch up his ship. Yet even so, he was satisfied. The Norfolk's obvious duty, always supposing that she was in the Pacific at all and not down in the high southern latitude still battling with the westerlies, was to proceed steadily along the coast of Chile and Peru, lying to at night and looking for British whalers by day. So if he were to crack on for the Galapagos, there was a strong likelihood that he should get there first, or find her on the whaling grounds, or at the very least learn something of her destination. He had other causes for satisfaction. Although she had scarcely a boat of sailcloth or a tenpenny nail to spare once she'd put herself to rights, the ship was now taut and trim and beautifully dry. She was very well supplied with fresh water, fuel, stockfish and pickled seal, and her people were remarkably healthy. They'd only buried two, and that was at sea off Diego Ramirez. The others had responded wonderfully to fresh vegetables, fresh meat, warmth and plain creature comfort after the howling wet and incessant cold of the 60s. Furthermore, they'd been through so much together that they were now a united body of men. And the frightful passage had made something like sailors out of even the least promising defenders. Insensibly, they'd taken on the tone of the surprises. The old distinction, the old animosity had vanished. And they were not only far more efficient, but also much pleasanter to command. The grating hadn't been rigged since the remote days of the South Atlantic. There was only one man who still stood out, and that was the silly little ventriloquial barber Compton, who would be prating. There was also the gunner. He was not a former defender, but he too was a newcomer, and he too didn't fit in. He drank heavily, and he was probably going mad. Jack had seen a good many sea officers go mad. Although the captain of a man-of-war had immense powers, there was little he could do to prevent a man protected by a commission or a warrant from destroying himself, so long as he committed no offence against the Articles of War. And this Horner never did. Although he was a sombre, inhuman brute, he was a conscientious one, and he did his duty at all times. Yet even so, Jack couldn't like him. The reefers, on the other hand, how well they were coming on, and what an agreeable set of young fellows they were. He'd rarely known a pleasanter, more cheerful midshipman's berth. Perhaps it was the Greek. They'd behaved remarkably well coming round the Horn, although Boyle had had three ribs stove in, while frostbite had taken off two of Williamson's toes and the tips of his ears, and the scurvy, running to Callamy's scalp, had turned him as bald as an egg. And now they were having immense fun on Juan Fernandez, hunting goats with a troop of large feral dogs they'd more or less tamed. He smiled. But his pleasant thoughts were interrupted by a musket shot and the voice of Blakeney, the acting signal midshipman. "If you please, sir, Sugarloaf's signalling. A sail, I believe." A sail it was. But the eddying breeze up there streamed the rest of the hoist directly away from the ship. And rather than wait for it to come fair, Jack ran to the forecastle, filled his lungs, and hailed the Sugarloaf with enormous force. "Oh, whaler!" A combined yell of "No!" came down, with gestures of negation. But the answer to his "Where away?" couldn't be heard, though their outstretched arms pointed emphatically to leeward. And calling to Blakeney to follow him with a telescope, Jack climbed the four crosstrees. He searched the hazy northern rim of the sea, but nothing could he find, apart from a school of whales, blowing by the score some 5 miles away. "Sir," cried Blakeney, standing on the topgallant yard, "the hoist has come straight. I can read most of it without the book. Ship, bearing, nor-nor-east, something leagues. Can't make out the numeral, sir. Steering west." They were responsible men up there. Whateley, a quartermaster, and two middle-aged, able seamen. And a seaman's ship meant only one thing, a three-masted, square-rigged vessel. A frigate was, of course, a ship, and since this ship they were signalling somewhere beyond his range was not a whaler, and whalers could instantly be recognised from their crow's nests, she might well be the Norfolk. Might very well be the Norfolk. "Mr. Blakeney," he said, "jump up to the Sugarloaf with a glass. Take all the notice you can of what sail she's under and her course and bearing. Then bring the men and their belongings down. You may come as quick as you like, unless you choose to spend the rest of your days on this island. We shall never beat back to it in this breeze once we've gone to leeward." Then, raising his voice and sending it aft, "Mr. Honey there! All hands, unmoor ship, if you please." Every man aboard and several ashore had been expecting the order, ever since the Sugarloaf answered the captain's hail. And even before the boatswain raised his call, the deck was as busy as an upturned anthill. Purposefully busy, however, with capstan bars hurrying to be shipped, pinned and swifted, topmen running to veer away the head cable, forecastlemen vanishing below to the cable tier, there to coil the stern cable as the monstrous wet, stiff and heavy rope came in. It took a great deal more than a sudden order to unmoor ship to make the Surprise lose her head. And busy though she seemed, or even to a landsman's eye distracted, she found plenty of time to break out the Blue Peter at the fore and fire a gun to draw attention to it. The gun stopped Stephen and Martin dead, and before they could gather their wits and begin to reflect upon the reasons for the report, they were turned about and hurried down the goat path, losing half an hour's laborious climb in 5 minutes. Neither Bondon nor Calamy would attend to any speculation, any remarks about hummingbirds, about reckless, unnecessary haste, or the beetles left among the tree ferns for a moment. And although there was a long way to go through the sandalwood trees and behind the sea elephant's cove, the only place on the island where Venus Mercenari is to be found, cried Martin in anguish as he was heaved past it at a brisk trot, they brought their charges to the strand as the last three invalids, one broken leg that wouldn't knit, one amputated forearm gangrened after frostbite, and one perfectly irrelevant tertiary syphilis acquired years ago behind a Hampshire hedge, were handed into the Red Cutter, attended by Higgins, and as the fife on the capstan head died away, the Surprise being right over her stern anchor, having reached the point where the ritual words were spoken, "Up and down, sir," and then "Thick and dry for weighing." These were followed by an anxious period, for the anchor had dragged a little, and there was danger of its being in foul ground. The fife struck up, and the men heaved hearty, but the capstan moved slower and slower. The shooting party arrived, all crammed into one boat, and the Liberty men flung themselves upon the bars. "Heave it away!" called the boatswain, as he felt a yielding tremor from the depths, and the capstan began to turn with a fine click, click of its paws, raising the best bower through a murky cloud of sediment. "Heave and in sight!" But the best bower had moored the frigate by the stern, with the cable passing out of a gunroom port, and although the Surprises were pleased to see their anchor dangling there, they still had to pass it forward. This was a difficult task in itself, the best bower weighing 3,100 weight, and it was harder now, since at the same time they had to warp the ship across the bay to heave up the second anchor laid out ahead. A period of intense activity ensued, with the capstan turning steadily to the tune of "All aboard for Cuckold's Reach," and the boatswain and his mates leaping to and fro, inboard and out, like so many passionate apes. Some time passed before Jack had leisure to say, "There you are, Doctor. There you are, Mr. Martin. I'm sorry to have torn you from your botanizing, but I'm happy to see you aboard. We may have our enemy under our lee. We must sail directly, and with the wind so steady in the south, anyone left behind is likely to stay there a great while. Mr. Mowat, all the people are aboard, I believe?" "No, sir," said Mowat. "The gunner, his wife and Hollam are still ashore."
"Mr. Horner?" cried Jack. "God's my life, I could have sworn he came in the launch. Give him another gun."
They gave him three guns at long intervals while the Surprise moved steadily across the bay. But it was not until she was almost over her small bower with the cables sloping steep that he was reported at the landing place. Alone at the landing place.
"What the devil does he mean? What the hell are they about gathering nosegays?
Said Jack, glancing angrily over the pure sea, just ruffled now by a most welcome breeze blowing the way of the tide.
Send the jolly boat for them. Yes, Mr. Holler, what is it?
I beg pardon, sir, said the boatswain. Capstan's up to his old capers again.
Red hell and death, said Jack. Surge the messenger.
They surged the messenger, taking the strain off the cable, and Jack crawled under the bars to the iron pawl rim. True enough, one of the pawls had already lost its tip, and the other was so distorted that it might go any minute. And if it were to go when the cable was taut, any heave of the sea, any lift of the ship, would be transmitted to the bars with shocking force, spinning the capstan backwards and scattering the men like ninepins, bloody ninepins.
"Shall I have the forge set up, sir?"
asked Mowat.
"It would have to be done sooner or later. New pawls would have to be shaped, hammered, tempered, just so, and fitted. But this would take hours, and they would lose not only the tide, but the promising little air that was stirring the pennant."
"No," said Jack, "we shall weigh with a voil to the jeer capstan." As he spoke, he saw a horrified look spread on the boatswain's face. Mr. Holler had always served in modern ships, and he'd never weighed with a voil. Indeed, it was an antiquated practice, but as a youngster, Jack had sailed under some very conservative, antiquated captains, and it also happened that his very first command, the Sophie, an old-fashioned brig if ever there was one, had habitually used a voil. With scarcely a pause, Jack called the midshipman.
"I'll show you how we weigh with a voil," he said. "Take notice, you don't often see it done, but it may save you a tide of the first consequence."
They followed him below to the manger board, where he observed, "This is a voil with a difference.
Carry on, Sophie fashion, Bondon."
For Bondon had already brought the big, single-sheaved block.
"Watch now. He makes it fast to the cable. He reeves the jeerfall through it. The jeerfall is brought to its capstan, with the standing part belayed to the bits. So you get a direct runner purchase instead of a dead nip. Do you understand?"
They understood. But the voil block, so long unused, broke under the strain. It had to be replaced by various makeshifts, and by the time the cable was truly up and down and Jack on deck again, the jolly boat was lying empty alongside, its crew already busy at their various stations. As he walked aft, he saw Maitland speaking to Mowat, who came forward to meet him, took off his hat, and said in an odd, formal voice,
"The gunner has come aboard, sir. He came alone. He says Holland has deserted, will not rejoin the ship, and that Mrs. Horner is staying with him. He says they mean to stay on the island. He hurt his leg in the woods and has gone below."
The atmosphere was very strange. Jack checked his first reply and glanced about the quarter-deck. Most of the officers were there. Not one had a wholly natural expression on his face. Two of the jolly boat's crew were close by, clearing away the falls, and they looked deeply perturbed, anxious, and, as it were, frightened. Obviously there was something known in the ship, and obviously no one was going to tell him. Even Maturin's face was closed. The decision had to be made at once, and he would have to make it himself. Ordinarily, any deserter had to be taken up. The example was of the first importance. But this was a special case. Searching the island with all its caves and deep recesses might take a week, at a time when a possible enemy was in sight. While his mind was turning to and fro, he was tempted to say, "Has the gunner made no representations about pursuing them, about recovering his wife?" When he realised that the answer was implicit in Mowat's account, the question was pointless. In any case, his mind was clear and unsettled. He said, "Up anchor," adding, "We shall deal with the question of desertion at a later time, if possible. Carry on, Mr. Maitland."
"Away aloft!" cried Maitland. And the men ran up onto the yards. "Trice up and lay out!" And they cast off the gaskets, holding the sails under their arms. "Let fall! Sheet home!" The sails dropped. The larboard watch sheeted home the foretopsail. The starboard watch the main topsail. And the boys and idlers the mizzen. Then, slightly ahead of the order, they manned the halyards and ran the yards up. The topgallants followed. The sails were trimmed to the breeze. And as the Surprise, moving easily over her small bower, plucked it up with scarcely a check, they ran back to the capstan and heaved the cable in. The hands went through these motions with the unthinking ease of very long practice, but in something near dead silence. There was none of the cheerful excitement of getting to sea in great haste with the possibility of action not far ahead. Most of them had seen the gunner come aboard. His ghastly sunken face, his blood-spattered clothes. Some had heard the inhuman mechanical voice in which he reported to the officer of the watch. And the crew of the jolly boat told how he'd washed his hands and head kneeling there at the edge of the sea. Once the ship was clear of the island's lee, she set stunsails aloft and alow and steered a course designed to intercept the stranger. Blakeney had taken her bearing with great care, and he'd made out that she was on the larboard tack, at least 1 point free under courses and topsails. The Surprise was now making 8 knots, and Jack hoped to raise her in the evening. Then, taking in all but his staysails until nightfall, and lurking under the horizon, as it were, to come up with her at dawn under a press of canvas. Up at the main cross-trees, he scanned the far sea with his telescope, sweeping a 20-degree arc from the starboard leech of the fore-topgallant, and below him he heard the men in the foretop, unaware of his presence, talking in low, urgent voices, little more than a whisper. They were upset, more upset than could be accounted for by a master's mate bolting with a gunner's wife on a warm and pleasant island. Whales again. A perfectly enormous school of them spouting over not much more than a mile of sea. He'd never seen so many together. Certainly more than 200. "Innocent blood in the sun," said a voice in the foretop. Vincent, a West Country lay preacher. "Innocent blood, my arse," said another. Probably old Phelps. And beyond the whales, far beyond the whales, a pale flash that was certainly not a spout. He focused his glass and steadied it. The stranger, sailing steadily along, holding her course. Hull down, of course, but quite certainly there. Turning his head and leaning down, he hailed the deck, an absurdly moderate hail, as though the distant ship might hear. "On deck there! Into gallants!" He made his way slowly down, gave the orders that should keep the Surprise out of sight but still moving on a course parallel with the stranger's, and walked into his cabin. He was very much a creature of his ship, and although his life was so comparatively isolated, he was keenly aware of the atmosphere aboard. In tune with it, too, since his intense, eager looking forward to the morning was now deadened to a surprising degree. Obviously this didn't prevent him from taking every proper measure. He and the master laid a very exactly calculated course. Deadlights were shipped before dark, so that not a glimmer should show aboard. And half an hour after sunset, the ship swung 5.5 points north, increasing her speed on the regular unvarying breeze to 7 knots, with perhaps 2 in reserve if she needed to spread more canvas. He said to Merritt, "It would be inhuman to harass poor Horner this evening. Let's assume that he's gone sick and ask his oldest mate to report Wilkins, isn't it? A solid man. I've no doubt about the state of the guns, but we may need some more cartridge filled, particularly if we're lucky tomorrow. Then, as the ship sailed evenly through the moonless night with a long easy pitch and rise on the following swell, and with the regular hum of her rigging transmitted to the cabin as an omnipresent, comfortable sound, laced through, as it were, with the run of the water along her side, he returned to his serial letter to Sophie. Although a captain's married to his ship, it is with him as it is with some other husbands. There are certain things he is the last to know. There's certainly more in this than meets the eye, at least more than meets my eye. The people are shocked, and I might even say grieved. And this wouldn't have been brought about merely by what he said to have happened. A warrant officer's wife leaving him and a master's mate walking Spanish. I hate and distrust talebearers, and I have no opinion of captains who listen to them, still less encourage them. And although I'm morally certain that Mowat and Killick and Bondon, to name only three who have been shipmates with me time out of mind, know very well what's afoot, I'm equally certain, and not one will tell me without I ask him straight, which I shall not do. There's only one person I might decently speak to as a friend, and that is Stephen. But whether he'd tell me or not, I cannot say. He paused, a long, long pause, and then called, "Killick! Killick there! My compliments to the doctor, and if he should care for a little music, I'm at his service." With this, he took his fiddle out of its case and began tuning it, a series of pings, squeaks, and groans that made a curiously satisfying pattern of their own, and that began moving his mind on to another plane. The old Scarlatti in D minor, and a set of variations on a theme of Haydn's, that they handed to and fro with some pleasant improvisations, moved it somewhat farther. But neither was in a mood to be wholly possessed by music. And when Killick came in with the wine and biscuits, Jack said, "We must turn in early. It's not impossible we may find the Norfolk tomorrow. Unlikely, but not impossible. But before turning in, I should like to ask you something. It may be improper, and I shall not take it amiss if you don't choose to reply. What do you think of this desertion?"
"Listen, my dear," said Stephen. "It is an awkward thing asking a ship's surgeon about any of her people, because they've nearly all of them been his patients at one time or another, and a medical man may no more discuss his patients than a priest his penitents, God forbid. I will not tell you what I think of this desertion, so, nor what I think of the people concerned in it. But, if you wish, I will tell you of what is commonly thought, though without giving you any warrant of its truth or falsity, and without adding any views of my own or any private knowledge I may possess."
"Pray do so, Stephen."
"Well, now, it was generally supposed that Holland has been Mrs. Horner's lover for a considerable time, that Horner discovered it a week or so ago."
"Enough to make any man run mad," said Jack.
"And that he took the opportunity of leading them to the far side of the island on the pretext of a private conversation, and there battering them to death. He had a bludgeon with him, and he is shockingly strong. He is said to have carried their bodies to the cliff and thrown them over. The people grieve for Mrs. Horner, so young,
And she was good-natured, kind, and uncomplaining, too. They are sorry for Holland to some degree, but above all they regret he ever came aboard. An unlucky man. Yet they feel that Horner was intolerably provoked, and although they don't like him, they think he was within his rights.
I dare say they do, said Jack. And if I know anything of the Navy, they'll not give him away.
Not a scrap of evidence will they ever produce. An inquiry would be perfectly useless. Thank you, Stephen. That was what I wanted to know. And I dare say, if I'd been a little sharper, I shouldn't have had to ask. I'll have to take the thing at its face value. Put an R against poor Holland's name and meet Horner's eye as best I can. In the event, there was no difficulty about meeting Horner's eye. At the end of the middle watch, the chase's lights were seen a little, but only a very little farther west than they should have been. And at first dawn, there she lay, placidly holding her course under the low grey sky. Jack was on deck in his nightshirt, but Horner was there before him. The gunner was dressed in fresh white canvas trousers and new checked shirt. A wounded or twisted leg made his movements awkward, but he stumped about his guns, inspecting equipment, sights, and breaching with his usual surly competence. He came aft to the quarter-deck carronade, spreading intense wooden embarrassment all round, but apparently feeling none himself. He touched his hat to the captain, standing there with the lowered night-glass in his hand. Jack's whole heart and soul had been turned to the chase. He had been engaged in naval war for more than 20 years, and he was very much of a sea predator, perfectly single-minded when there was the near likelihood of violent action. And now, in the most natural voice in the world, he said, "Good day to you, Master Gunner. I fear there'll be no great chance of expending your stores this morning." The rising sun proved that he was right. It showed a line of figures leaning along the stranger's rail in easy attitude, some with moustaches, some smoking cigars. The United States Navy, though easy-going and even at times verging upon the democratic, never went to such extremes as this. And indeed the chase turned out to be the Estrella Polar, a Spanish merchantman from Lima for the River Plate and Old Spain. She was perfectly willing to heave to and pass the time of day, and although she couldn't spare the surprise anything but a few yards of sailcloth in exchange for bar iron, she was generous with information. Certainly, the Norfolk had passed into the Pacific, and that after an easy passage of the Horn. She had watered at Valparaiso, scarcely needing to reef it at all, which was just as well, since Valparaiso was notorious for possessing nothing, and that nothing of the very lowest quality, as well as exorbitantly dear and delivered only after endless delay. She'd sailed as soon as her water was completed, and she'd captured several British whalers. The Australia had heard tell of one burning at sea off the Lobos Rocks like an enormous torch in the night, and had spoken to another, the Acapulco by name, which was being taken to the States by a prize crew. A stout ship, but like most whalers, a slug. The Australia could give her fore and main to gallantsails and still sail 2 miles for her one. Had met her under the tropic line, 200 leagues north or east, a great way off. The Australia would be happy to carry the surprise's letters to Europe and wished her a happy voyage. The two ships filled their backed topsails and drew apart, calling out civilities. The Spaniard's last audible words over half a mile of sea were, "Que no haya novedad." "What did he mean by that?" asked Captain Aubrey. "May no new thing arise," said Stephen, new things being of their nature bad. The surprises were glad to have their letters carried back to the old world. They were grateful for the half bolt of canvas, and they said goodbye to the Australia with real goodwill. Yet, after a night of the liveliest expectation and the triumph of seeing her lights in the middle watch, she couldn't be anything but an anticlimax, a bitter disappointment. There was also the intense mortification of the Norfolk's having rounded the Horn so much before them, and of her snapping up the British whalers they'd been sent to protect. Many surprises had friends or relations in the South Sea fishery, and they felt it keenly. Mr. Allen, most of all. He'd always been a stern, unsmiling officer when he had the watch, not exactly a hard horse, since he never abused or wantonly harassed the men, but taut, very taut indeed, and now he became more so. He had the afternoon watch that day when the sun lowered and began to weep thin rain. The breeze grew capricious, sometimes baffling, and he kept the hands perpetually on the run, making sail, trimming it, taking it in again, all in a harsh and angry bark. He'd had a long conference with Jack, and they decided that in view of the Australia's information, the best course was to bear in with the main, keeping as close to the homeward-bound whaler's path as possible. This was not the Surprise's direct route for the Galapagos, but, insisted the master, they would lose little time. It was almost as broad as it was long, because of the cold current that flowed north along the coast, carrying seals and penguins right up almost as far as the equator, the whole length of Chile and Peru. Allen's reasoning and his experience of these waters seemed conclusive to Jack, and the ship was now steering as nearly east-nor-east as she could through the cheerless drizzle. A cheerless, uneasy ship. They'd got rid of one unlucky man in Poor Hollum, as they all called him now, but they'd gained a far worse. A fellow who must necessarily bring a curse upon them all. The youngsters were pitifully affected. Mrs. Horner had always been very kind to them, and apart from that, they'd been as sensible of her good looks as grown men. Jack abruptly shifted their quarters, making the mess with Ward, his clerk, Higgins, and the tall American midshipman. Ward didn't care for their company, although they were red-eyed and quiet as mice at present, but it was intolerable that they should stay with Horner. The gunner celebrated his freedom by getting drunk. He compelled one of his mates to sit with him, and the much less reluctant Barber Compton, the one person aboard who could by any stretch of the word be called his crony. Horner was well found in stores, having three breakers of Spanish brandy left, and they drank until the graveyard watch, when, to their horror, the hands on deck heard his thick, harsh voice singing, "Come it late or come it soon, I shall enjoy my rose in June." Day after day, the Surprise sailed through troubled seas with the ship labouring heavily, and every night Horner sat drinking with the barber, whose shrill, ventriloquial voice could be heard going through his set pieces again and again, followed by the deep, rumbling tones of the half-drunk Horner growing confidential. It shocked the men on deck. It shocked the men below. Even when she reached the cool, turquoise water of the Peru Current one clear day at noon, and raised the jagged line of the Cordillera of the Andes, sparkling white in the clear sky, far, far on the starboard beam as she turned northward, the mood in the ship remained the same. The hands were oppressed and silent. They thought Compton mad to hobnob with the gunner, and they were not surprised when one night there was the sound of fighting, and he came racing up on deck, his face covered with blood and the gunner hard after him. Horner tripped and fell. They picked him up, dead drunk, and carried him below.
Compton had no more than a cut mouth and a bloodied nose, but he was so frightened he could hardly stand. And to those who wiped him, he said, "I only told him she'd been got with child." The next day the gunner sent to say that he wished to consult Dr. Maturin, who received him in his cabin. The man was perfectly steady in his movements, but there was no human contact with him. He was so pale that his tan showed ochre, a dull ochre, and Stephen had the impression that he was filled with an almost ungovernable rage. "I've come to see you, Doctor," he said. Stephen bowed but made no reply. "She was in Kindle when she took sick," said the gunner suddenly. "Listen, Mr. Horner," said Stephen, "you are speaking of your wife, and I must tell you that I cannot discuss my patients with anyone. She was in Kindle and you used an instrument on her. I have nothing to say to you on this matter." Horner stood up, crouching under the beams, and said in a much rougher tone, "She was in Kindle and you used an instrument on her." The door opened. Padin stepped quickly in and took Horner from behind, circling his arms. Padin was an even bigger man and stronger by far. "Put him down now, Padin," said Stephen. "Mr. Horner, sit in that chair. Your mind is disturbed. You are upset, as well you may be, with so much emotion. You need physic. Drink this." He poured half a wine glass of his own tincture and passed it, saying, "I will not pretend not to know what you mean, but you must understand that I have never used an instrument in that sense in all my life, nor ever shall." He spoke with an authentic kindness. And this, perhaps even more than the evident truth, pierced through. The gunner drank his glass. It was a dose that should have calmed a dozen men unused to the drug, but that afternoon Higgins came to see Stephen in a state not so much of alarm as of abject terror. He said, "I used an instrument on her." "Oh, sir, you must protect me. I'm your assistant. I'm your mate. You must protect me. He respects you. He don't respect me at all." That was true enough. Higgins' patter had been repeated too often. His rapacity had become too naked, and had been so foolish as to tyrannise over the loblolly boy, a medical oracle of great standing with the lower deck, who revealed many of his capers, privately showing his shot-wall earwigs in the aged stag-beetle. And in any case, Stephen's trepanning of place had quite wiped out what little triumphs Higgins may have had with teeth. "You'd better keep out of his way until he's quietened," said Stephen. "You may stay in the sick bay reading to the invalids. I will ask Padin to sit with you for a day or so. You must conciliate his goodwill, somewhat thoughtlessly impaired, by speaking to him civilly, perhaps by making him a small present." "Oh, sir, I'll give him half a guinea, a whole guinea. I'll give him 2 guineas, honest fella. And I shall never leave the sick bay except to turn in, and then, never you fear, sir, I'm surrounded by hammocks on all sides, and the big American midshipman is between me and the door." Yet on the Friday, that clouded, miserable day when Stephen and Martin were dissecting a pelican, one of the many creatures that Howard the Marine had shot as the ship sailed along the fertile current, much frequented by penguins, dolphins, and all kinds of seals, sea lions and sea bears, as well as unbelievably vast shoals of little fishes like anchovies and their attendant birds overhead, Martin said, "What do they mean by a Jonah's lift?" Before Stephen could answer, Howard came below and told them that a strange, enormous thing, rather like a sea elephant, had come within range. He'd fired, but had hit only the young one that was with it, a veil of mist coming between him and his mark at the crucial moment.
He wished they'd seen the animal. It was prodigious like a human being, though bigger and what he might call grey in colour. He wished very much they'd seen it.
"I'm sure you mean very kindly, Mr. Howard," said Stephen. "But let me beg you not to shoot more creatures than we can collect or dissect, or than the men can eat, for our love."
"Oh, you've never been a one for sporting, Doctor," said Howard with a laugh. "Why, you could shoot all day long in these waters. Was you fond of sporting? Just now I had the prettiest right and left among a flight of cormorants. I shall go straight back to it. I have two men loading for me."
"A Jonah's lift, did you say?"
said Stephen. "I believe it is a term they use when they speak of an unpopular, unlucky man having been pushed over the side."
"Oh, surely not," said Martin, who was ignorant of these later developments. "I heard it used of Mr. Higgins."
"Did you indeed?" said Stephen.
"Pray stretch the skin till I come back."
Higgins was not in the sick bay nor in his berth. And as Stephen looked for him, he caught significant glances exchanged by some of the men. He took the loblolly boy aside and said, "Listen, Jamie Pratt, when did you see him last?"
"Well, sir," said Jamie, "he doesn't go to the hedge, you know. He bottled himself up or used a pot, but last night he had a roaring old flux and went forwards, it being wholly dark, which I ain't seen him since. I thought he was maybe with you, maybe in his berth, or maybe in the cable tier. I heard tell he has a hidey-hole down there, being main frightened of a certain gent, as you might say.
Sure, he'll be in his place at quarters if he's been hiding below," said Stephen.
The drum beat. The bulkheads vanished. The frigate showed a clean sweep fore and aft, ready for battle, and all hands ran to their action stations. Mowat made his rapid inspection in order to be able to report to the captain, "All hands present and sober, sir, if you please." He found the boatswain on the forecastle, of course, the carpenter and his crew at the pumps and in the wings, and the gunner, his yeoman and his mates, at their posts in the magazines. But when he came to the shady depths where Stephen, Martin and the loblolly boy stood ready to attend the wounded, Stephen said, "Sir, I have to report the absence of my assistant, Mr. Higgins." Quarters ended with no great gun exercise. The drama beat the retreat, and Jack ordered a thorough searching of the lower platforms and the hold. Higgins might have been taken ill inside one of the great coils of cable on the tiers, or he might have fallen down a hatchway. The men lit their lanterns in the rapidly gathering dusk. Low cloud was already wafting through the upper rigging, and began going through the necessary motions. But their hearts were not in it. Of course their hearts were not in it, since they knew as an evident fact that Higgins had been given a Jonah's lift. And no great loss either. And when the wailing started, they all hurried up on deck, standing there in a huddle. It was a wailing, a great, long, desperately sad oh, of immense volume, sometimes rising to a shriek unlike any sound that had come from the sea in the experience of the oldest man aboard. And it circled the ship, coming quite close on either side. Sometimes a form could be made out, but never clearly. In any case, there were few who dared to look.
"What can it be?" asked Jack.
"I cannot tell," said Stephen, "but suppose it to be the creature whose young one was shot. Perhaps it was wounded, and perhaps it has now died." The voice grew louder still, almost intolerable, before it broke off in a dying sob.
"Mr. Mowat," said Jack in a most uneasy tone, "has the ship been thoroughly searched?"
"I'm not quite sure, sir," said Mowat, raising his voice above the wail now on the larboard beam. "I'll find out directly."
There was the same answer to all his questions. Yes, everything had been rummaged. And no, there was no good going down there again. They were responsible warrant and petty officers who spoke, sometimes lying to his face. And he knew and they knew that there would be no getting the men to return to remoter, darker, more lonely parts of the ship. "God's my life!" cried Jack, the empty watch-glass catching his eye, the half-hour-glass that was religiously turned even in the heat of battle, even when the ship was settling in the sea, her bottom pierced. "God's my life, what the devil are you thinking of? Turn the glass and strike the bell!" The marine on duty turned the glass and reluctantly moved forward. 8 hesitant bells and the howling all around. "Set the watch!" said Jack. "Judas Priest, what are you all standing about for? Mr. Moet Lanterns will be allowed on the berth deck tonight after lights out. Master-at-arms, take notice of that." He paused to see that the watch was indeed mustered. For a moment he thought it mightn't be accomplished, for although he'd often seen sailors disturbed, alarmed, unsettled, he'd never known them so frightened as this, nor so utterly cast down. But most of the officers were on deck, and the stolid, wholly unimaginative presence of Mr. Adams, eagerly discussing the storage of bottled ale with Stephen and Martin, helped Maitland through his task. Once the last name was called, Jack walked into his cabin where he paced to and fro athwartships, his hands behind his back, and all the time the terrible great cry moved round the ship. "Pass the word for the doctor," he said at last. "And when Stephen came, I hear that Martin asked about a Jonah's lift. I know what's said among the people, and I've been reflecting. This cannot go on. Tell me, since it's generally held that the gunner has committed monstrosities, could you certify that he's mad and must be placed under restraint?"
"I could not. Many a man has done what he's said to have done and is still reckoned sane. I couldn't certify a man mad on supposition. No, nor on the most vehement suspicion either, nor even on legal proof, without examining what can be made out of his mind to know whether he acted rationally, to know with at least that faint light of knowledge that can come from one man's fallible examination."
"Examination?" said Jack. "Very well." He rang and said, "Pass the word for the gunner." He sat there, lost in thought, as the cry went forward. The howling outside had diminished while they were speaking, but now it rose to a shriek even higher than before. "What can it be?" asked Jack again, deeply disturbed.
"Sure, I cannot tell," said Stephen, crossing himself. "Conceivably something of the manatee kind, though the latitude is wrong entirely. God, between us and evil."
"Amen," said Jack. And the door opened. Killick, appalled, could scarcely speak.
"Gunner's hanged hisself,"
he brought out in a gasp. "Have you cut him down?" cried Jack. Stephen saw the answer in Killick's stupid look, pushed past him and ran forward, calling to Bondon and a boatswain's mate as he ran. "Lift him up till I cut the cord," he said. They laid him on his cot, and it was there that Martin saw him, with Stephen sitting by his head. "There is hope, is there not?" said Martin, looking at their dark, suffused, expressionless face. "There's no question of dislocation, surely?"
"No drop, no dislocation,"
said Stephen. "So there is certainly hope. I've known a man hang 20 minutes and still be revived by proper measures. Why, he's still warm. Do you detect a pulse?"
"I believe I may."
"When shall you bleed him?" "I don't mean to instruct you, Maturin, but should he not be let blood directly?"
"I don't think bleeding would answer in this case,"
said Stephen, and after a while he went on. "Have you ever brought a determined suicide back to life? Have you seen the despair on his face when he realizes that he has failed, that it is all to do again? It seems to me a strange thing to decide for another.
Surely living or dying is a matter between a man and his maker, or unmaker.
I cannot think you're right,
said Martin, and he set out the contrary view.
Sure you speak with great authorities on your side,
said Stephen. He stood up and lent his ear to the gunner's chest, then opened his eye, gazing into it with a candle.
But in any case, he's now gone beyond my interference, God rest his soul.
Martin shook his head and said, I cannot give him Christian burial, alas. Then, after a moment, the wailing has stopped.
It stopped while you were speaking 5 minutes ago, said Stephen.
I believe the best thing to do is to send for his mates, who will sew him up in a hammock with round shot at his feet. I shall watch by him until the morning, when he can be slipped over first thing without distressing the hands even further. For I must tell you, Martin, the more superstitious of them are quite capable of pining away under this kind of strain. Like blacks, when they have been cursed.
But first thing in the morning, or rather before, it was also the time when the Surprise sent men to the masthead to see what the new lit ocean might have on its surface. Rare were the gifts it offered, but still the men laid aloft at a tearing pace even in such times as these, since before now the frigate had found an opponent or a prize lying there within range of her guns. 364 mornings of the year might show nothing, or only a distant fisherman, but there was always the possibility of an exceptional dawn, and this was one of them. The shrieking hail of "Sail ho!" cut short all the rumbling activity of Holystones and Bears.
"Where away?" called the master, who had the watch.
"Right in the wind's eye, sir," said the lookout. "Just topsails up in a whaler, I do believe."
A few minutes later, with the light spreading fast and the last stars dying in the west, Jack was plucked from a troubled, anxious sleep by the ship's change of course through 64 degrees, and by young Boyle's voice loud in his ear bringing, "Mr. Allen's duty, sir, and a sail in the south-southwest, a whaler, we do believe." When he came on deck, he found a fresh and brilliant morning, the Surprise close-hauled on the larboard tack, and a somewhat nervous master who said,
"I've presumed to alter courses, since she may be an American or a prize of ours going home."
"Quite right, Mr. Allen," said Jack, fixing the chase's topsails as they nicked the clear horizon. "Quite right. There wasn't a moment to lose. It'll be tack upon tack as hard as ever we can pelt to make up such a leeway."
"Another thing, sir," said Allen in a low voice. "Pearson up, John," two of the Gibraltar lunatics who had laid the hammock-shrouded gunner on the gangway, "didn't quite understand, and they launched Mr. Horner over the side when the ship hauled to the wind."
"Perhaps it was for the best," said Jack, shaking his head. "Perhaps it was..."
"Forward there! Sharp that main to bowline! Mr. Allen, I believe she'll wear fore and main to gallantsels."
With the sun a broad hand's breadth clear of the sea, he was on deck again, standing there with one arm hooked round the weathermizzen topmast backstay. The Surprise had finished her morning rituals, and now all hands and her captain were settling down to the task of sailing her as fast as ever she could go without undue risk to her precious spars, sailcloth and cordage. The chase was half topsails under, 13 or 14 miles away, and had she been going large, the frigate would probably have overhauled her by dinner time. But they must have passed one another in the night, and she was now directly to windward. The Surprise would therefore have to beat up against a head sea in a stiff and freshening breeze, and she would have to make up that distance before the sun set and the moonless night hid the whaler from view. It could be done, but it called for very keen seamanship, a very close study of the ship's capabilities, and a very particular trim to carry weather helm to a nicety. It did not call in vain. The Surprise was using every possible racing manoeuvre to eat
the wind out of the chase. The most expert helmsmen were at the wheel in pairs, determined not to yield an inch of leeway, perpetually watching for a smooth to edge her a little closer to the wind, while expectant hands carried out the slightest change of trim that Jack called for, with the flashing perfection of long practice and the keenest zeal. For his part, he felt in perfect touch with his ship. Sailing on a bowline was something both he and she could do admirably well. And as he stood there, swaying to the heave of the deck, he was aware of her slightest swerve or check. He was wearing an old blue coat, for the morning was fresh, although they were so near the tropic line, and the spray and even solid water that swept aft every time the Surprise shouldered one of the steeper seas was fresher still, turning his new-shaved face a fine, bright pink. From the masthead he'd seen that the whaler was British-built. He was convinced that she was an American prize, and without a word passing, this conviction had communicated itself to the crew. All the old Surprises knew that if a British ship had been 24 hours in the enemy's possession, it was not yielded up to the former owners with a polite bow and the hope of a piece of plate in acknowledgement, but became salvage, the next best thing to a prize, or in some cases even better and more direct. When Stephen came up onto the steeply sloping deck quite late in the day, he'd been woken by the fife playing Nancy Dawson for the hand's noontime grog, he had an impression of all-pervading blueness. Blue sky with a few high white clouds after all these days of low grey. A darker blue white-flecked sea. Even blue air and the great shadowed convexities of the straining sails. "Good afternoon to you, Doctor," called Jack, blue coat and bright blue eyes gleaming. "Come and take a look at our chase." Stephen slowly made his way aft, handed along by the jolly marines and all the seamen who, having no immediate task in hand, were lining the weather rail so that their weight should make the ship a little stiffer. And as he went, he felt the total change of mood. The people's hearts and minds were wholly set on the pursuit, intent, eager, cheerful. The past, and even the events of yesterday, left behind, far behind, with the long-vanished wake. "There she lays," said Jack, nodding over the larboard beam, where the whaler could be seen standing southeast under topgallantsails with her starboard tacks aboard. "But you're going almost directly from it," cried Stephen. "What kind of chase is this at all?" "Why, she's very much concerned with her southing, do you see," said Jack, "and she wears about every 2 hours or so. She's on the starboard tack now, as you see. Yet wearing ship takes time. And in any case, I don't care to arouse her suspicions. So we don't go about. We sail as nearly south as we can, but on the other tack. I believe she's as innocent as a babe unborn. Takes us for a Spaniard. We put all that filth up there to encourage her to think so." Stephen peered up, and after some searching, he saw a little piece of dimity, about the size of a moderate tea tray, fluttering at the junction of two ropes and a few untidy reef points. "But next time she wears, we shall be on what look like parallel courses, though in fact they'll be converging, since we lie much closer as well as sailing faster. And I reckon that if all goes well, if we carry nothing away, then in 4 more of her boards and 1 or perhaps 2 of ours, we should have the weather gauge."
"You mean to take her, I collect?"
"That's the general idea."
"What makes you suppose she's lawful prize?"
"She's British built to begin with. And then, although her commander sails her tolerably well, he doesn't sail her as a man who had had her for a year or so would sail her. A weak crew, too. Whereas whalers' crews are strong. They take a great while wearing. You shall watch through my glass next time they make a leg. Everything points to her being a prize. Probably the ship that worthy Spaniard spoke of, the Acapulco. When do you hope to come up with her, so?" "Come," said Jack, "don't let's tempt fate. I only say that if all goes well, if we carry nothing away and the breeze is freshening, as you see..."
"It's already far more like a tempest than any breeze."
"Then we might, with luck, speak her before dark." Here the drum beat for the gunroom dinner, and they parted, for Jack meant to stay on deck eating sandwiches brought by Killick. The dinner was a hurried meal, with most of the officers, including the American lieutenant, bolting their food so that they shouldn't miss a moment of the chase. Yet there was some conversation, from which it appeared that the surprise didn't set royals at about 3 bells when the whaler spread her t'gallantsails, partly from fear of losing them, but much more so that she wouldn't appear to be chasing. That the whaler certainly had a dirty bottom, she sagged horribly to leeward, that the people who sailed her were no phoenixes, and that nothing made Mowat happier than remembering the days they had so wisely spent at Juan Fernandez, heaving the barkie down as far as possible and cleaning her copper as far as ever they could reach. Painful at the time, but wonderfully pleasant in the recollection. Presently the purser, the chaplain and the surgeon were left to themselves, with the greater part of a long grey pudding made with Juan Fernandez berries. And Stephen observed, "I have seen many examples of the seaman's volatility, but none equal to this. When you recalled the last week, culminating in the events of yesterday, no longer ago than yesterday itself, when you recalled the silent, anxious, and I might almost say haunted faces, the absence not only of the unusual laughter, but even of quips and small wit, and the collective sense of impending ineluctable doom, and when you compare that with today's brisk gaiety, the lively eye, the hop, skip and jump, why, you are tempted to ask yourself whether these are not mere irresponsible, childish fribbles." "Fribble yourself," murmured the gunroom steward the other side of the door, where he was finishing the officer's wine with Killick. "Are weathercocks. But then you reflect that these same people circumnavigate the entire terraqueous globe, sometimes in trying circumstances, which argues a certain constancy. I have heard their levity put down to there being no more than a 9-inch plank between them and eternity," said Martin.
9-inch?
Said the purser, laughing heartily. "Why, if you're given to levity with 9 inches under you, what must you be in a little old light-built frigate, a flaming gas balloon, no doubt? God, dear me, there are parts of Surprise's bottom where you could push a penknife through with ease. 9-inch? Oh, Lord! Sir! Sir!" cried Calamy, running in and standing by Stephen's chair. "The whaler's taken in her t'gallantsails. We're to go about any minute now, and we'll overhaul her by the end of the watch as sure as eggs is eggs. Please, sir," with an affectionate look, "may I have a slice of pudding? Chasing's desperate, hungry work." As it happened, the Surprise overhauled her well before the end of the watch. The whaler, the unlucky Acapulco, wholly deceived by the Spanish ensign that Jack hoisted when they were a couple of miles apart, backed her foretopsail and lay to, while the captive American sailors stood in silent agony as the Surprise took up a raking position across the Acapulco's bows, ran out her broadside guns in one brisk movement, replaced the false colours with the true, and called upon her to surrender. There wasn't the least possibility of resistance, and her commander came across without any fuss, a disconsolate young man with spectacles. His name was Caleb Gill, and he was nephew to the Norfolk's captain, who had captured so many whalers that in spite of having burnt several, he was hard-pressed for officers to take the others in. The Surprises were very kind to Mr. Gill, as well they might be, since he'd done them no sort of harm, while his trusting nature had, with no great pains on their part, delivered them a prize, deep laden with white oil and spermaceti, mostly from other ships, that Mr. Allen reckoned at $100,000.
"That's very fine, to be sure," said Jack Aubrey, smiling at his report. "And heaven knows I'm not one to fling $100,000 in a gift horse's teeth. Yet, in a way, the carpenter and the boatswain have even better news. The Acapulco is stuffed with spars, cordage and sailcloth enough for a 3-year cruise. She's only been out 6 months and has hardly used anything at all." The gunroom was kind to Mr. Gill, and the other surprises were kind to his crew, which included some of the Acapulco's men, who, anxious to avoid the accusation of foreign enlistment or comforting the king's enemies, told all they had learnt about the Norfolk's movements past and to come. But it was Caleb Gill who gave the information that relieved Jack's mind from a most gnawing anxiety. Gill was a reading man, nearer akin to Martin and Stephen than to most of the other sailors. His interest, however, had more to do with men, primitive men, and less with botany or brute beasts than theirs. He was fascinated by the idea of the noble savage, and had travelled far among the Native Americans, learning all he could of their social order in peace and war, their laws, custom and history. And one afternoon, when the Surprise was still stripping the Acapulco of everything that could possibly be crammed between decks, and Mr. Lawrence was dining with Jack, the three of them lingered in the gunroom over a bottle of Madeira. "I was, of course, exceedingly mortified at being taken prisoner," he observed. "Yet, in a purely personal and private way, I have been perhaps even more deeply mortified by being ordered to take command of that unfortunate Acapulco, since, from the very beginning of the voyage, my whole heart had been bent on beholding the Marquesas. Your upas, Teresa, your two-toed sloth, dodo, solitary bird, were hardly more for you than the Marquesas were for me, particularly the island Huajiva, which my uncle has always represented as a paradise."
"As a paradise, indeed?"
asked Stephen, remembering a letter found in the Danae's packet which used that very phrase.
"Yes, sir, not perhaps quite an orthodox Presbyterian paradise, but one so agreeable that he means to set up a colony upon it. Indeed, he even has some colonists with him. I've heard differing and often muddle-headed accounts of the islanders' polity, but all agree that it pays great attention to various prohibitions or taboos and to relationship. And all agree that the people are most uncommonly amiable and good-looking, their only faults being cannibalism and unlimited fornication. But neither of these is erected into a religious system. Oh, no, the divine offerings are invariably swine, the cannibalism being simply a matter of taste or inclination, while the fornication has nothing ceremonial or compulsory about it."
"Does your uncle mean to reform the islanders?" asked Stephen.
"Oh, no, not at all," said Gill. "He thinks they could scarcely be improved upon. It's to be quite a utopian colony, Liberty Hall writ large. Yet even so, I long to see the people's way of life before it's changed in any way, and since I cannot now see it as a free man, why, I hope I shall see it as a prisoner. Captain Aubrey means to sail to the Marquesas, I take it. But perhaps my question is not quite discreet."
"Not at all, at all," said Stephen. "I'm not fully acquainted with his intentions, but I'll ask him, and I trust that we may all three tread the shores of Huajiva before the islanders have been corrupted."
"I hope so, too. Oh, yes, indeed," cried Gill, clasping his hands with eager anticipation.
Yet when Captain Aubrey had digested his information, and when his ship had taken in all the stores she could hold, he summoned the master and said, "Mr. Allen, a little while ago you observed that Butterworth and Kyle, the Acapulco's owners, had agents in Valparaiso."
"Yes, sir. And in Pisco, too, I believe. Most of the houses engaged in the South Sea fishery have agents in Chile or Peru." "I'm very glad to hear it, because I believe they may solve one of our difficulties. I cannot afford the officers and men to take the Acapulco home, yet I'm most unwilling to disappoint the people of their money. I therefore think of sending her into Valparaiso and delivering her up to the agents upon promise of salvage. At the same time, I can liberate all our American prisoners on parole. They're decent creatures in themselves, but considered absolutely, they're an infernal hellfire nuisance. And the prospect of housing and feeding them indefinitely weighs upon me. It weighs upon Mr. Adams, too, and this would be killing both birds." He paused, frowned, muttered over one stile, and went on, "Well, never mind. That would be the most seaman-like way of dealing with the situation, short of making them walk the plank."
"Very true, sir. But the point is this, Mr. Allen. The officer who takes her in must run the risk of being left behind. I've no intention of lying windbound in that bay. I've no intention of exchanging endless platitudes with port admirals, generals, governors, even bishops, God forbid. But all this can be avoided by a subordinate officer on plea of urgent orders. I should, therefore, escort the Acapulco to some point within sight of land and stand off and on for a day and a night. The officer would have to take her in with no more than the prisoners and, say, a cutter's crew, transact the business in an expeditious manner, and instantly proceed to sea, rejoining the ship in the cutter without the slightest loss of time. From all I understand, the Norfolk is likely to cruise on the Galapagos whaling grounds until the end of the month, and we may catch her there by cracking on. Nevertheless, I think this matter of the prize and the prisoners is worth 24 hours. 24 hours, but not a minute more. The officer would have to rejoin in that time. With your local knowledge, Mr. Allen, do you think the plan feasible?"
"Yes, sir, I do. And although I don't like to put myself forward, you'll allow me to mention that I know my way about Valparaiso. I speak the language tolerable, and I've been acquainted with Mr. Metcalf, the agent, these 20 years. "Very well, Mr. Allen, let's make it so. Pick your men and take command of the prize at once. If we're not to reach the Galapagos the morning after, the fare there is not a moment to be lost. Killick! Killick there! My compliments to the American officers, and I should like to see them directly.